Hi, welcome to Connectivity, episode 331, which it's a shame this isn't like episode 333 because we're going to be talking about Xenoblade 3.
Again.
And with me is my usual co-host, John Raritan, and also a man who played through Xenoblade 3. Whoa!
And can talk about it now, though we're still not going to, we're not going to talk about the story beyond... I won't go beyond the review embargo for the story, which...
I can't believe Shulk and Rex are now a couple.
Yep. Yeah, it was weird. You thought he'd wind up with Pyra or Mithra, but no. Hard swerve.
Shulk and Fiora? That's not endgame.
Nope. It's Shulk and Rex, which is slightly less pedophilic than Shulk and Pyra, but not pedophilic. So, like, you still get that as a bonus.
Still, like, a little weird.
Yeah,
How old is Rex supposed to be in Xenoblade 2?
They never say definitively, but there's a line where Nia asks him if he's like 12, and he gets upset and says that she's not much older than he is. That's the only reference we get to his age, but he is definitely under 18. It's implied that he is like maybe early teenager, like 14. He is a kid.
Yeah.
And Pyra, by comparison, is 500. So
we have her exact age, but somehow we don't have
it's like 500 and however long Torna was.
Rex just looks up and is like, you must be an angel. So Xenoblade 3, enough about 1 and 2. If you want to hear a lot more about Xenoblade 1 and 2, please go check out Matt Zawadniak's 45-minute video about the storytelling of Xenoblade 1 and 2.
It's so good, and
you can take that from someone who we both like Xenoblade 1. I don't like Xenoblade 2 and you like Xenoblade 2, and we both liked this video.
I don't want to spoil his video if you haven't seen it, but it looks at some areas of storytelling, not necessarily like story, but the actual telling of the story that Xenoblade 2 kind of fails at, that Xenoblade 1 really excelled at. And it's been interesting, because even as somebody who likes the story of Xenoblade 2, it's been fun to see how me and Matt kind of, like, see different things about that story. Like, I've learned a lot that I'm someone who, when I'm playing a game, is looking at kind of, like, the background lore of the world as the story, and Matt's looking at actual character arcs of the story. And so we can look at the same game and have very different reactions to how the story was.
It's something that we even kind of talked about it a little bit through the development and release of this video. But like, it has been getting me being like, oh, what do I value in video game storytelling?
Yeah.
And for me, I'm a sucker for ignoring the story. I mean, that's maybe to a little degree what I'm doing in Fire Emblem Warriors Three Hopes. I'm just in it for the Musou gameplay, damn it.
With that one, I assume that some of your knowledge from Three Houses carries over enough to be able to kind of skim.
I think Jordan and I mentioned it during the show that we definitely, I know I've had moments, and I know that he's mentioned to me that he had moments as well, where like, they're like, oh, look, it's this guy's back. And I'm like, who's that? Like, I don't remember who this is. I have to like look on Wikipedia. I'm like, oh, that's from the DLC. Okay. But I mean, it's also the overarching, I'm not necessarily deep into Three Houses and Three Hopes to an extent, and that, like, there's, like, between the alternate paths and the support conversations, and, like, there's so much story packed into that game. I've actually been catching myself thinking about how many different permutations of, like, lines have to be read for voice acting, because there's the three different paths, and you have people, like, referring to Edelgard as like emperor, and I'm like, well, I guess like there's probably the same support conversation or something similar with like this character in Dimitri, where it might be a similar line reading, but they would be saying king instead of emperor.
Yeah, you have to wonder like how, like, did they just record that one word twice, or did they re-record that entire line? Or
I mean, like, that's and you think about like the scale and how everything like twists together, because I mean, I feel like I have noticed that it seems like there's, I can't speak with authority with this, but like with Three Hopes, there might be less support conversations overall than there were in Three Houses, which honestly, I really have no idea, or I have no problem with that. Like, it's fine for what it is. Like, there are like some like fun character beats that show up in there, but the overarching story, like, I'm keeping an eye out for it, but that's not why I'm playing Three Hopes.
Yeah.
That's not even really why I don't know. It's a weird thing because I would say I don't really play Fire Emblem games for the story at all. I'm there for manipulating my team, leveling them up, you know, doing the pairing them off. I mean, which kind of came into vogue with Awakening's Future Babies system. But like that's what I'm there for. I'm not necessarily crassly treating my school kids in Three Houses and Three Hopes as like their Pokemon.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's that or trying to seduce them. So, like, it's not like there's a good option.
But it's, oh, man, it's so funny. Like, so there's, I guess, the seduction moments in Three Houses. I mean, all, like, just those bits that from past Fire Emblem games, they got weird where it was like, you can pet their face on the touchscreen. But they have those in Three Hopes where you go on an expedition with one of the characters. And, like, you, like, go on horses and then you're like, oh, we're going to sit down in this field. But periodically through the game, they're kind of like, oh, this character wants to go on an expedition. So I'm like, okay, let's go, Hubert. And Hubert is the serial killer looking MF-er. And it's just really funny because it's like this like well-lit scenario as he's like sitting in grass. And like, I forget exactly what his line is, but it's something about like, let's kill the infidels, something like that. And like the conversation, like then you have a conversation with them. And if you like have the right responses, then your support ranking will go up and you'll get bonuses and stuff. But like, it is the kind of thing where he's just like, what if we just killed all of our enemies? And I'm like, that sounds a little extreme, guy. But it's like, as it's just like this, like very softly lit, like beautiful summer scene.
Yeah.
Anyway, kind of getting off some of that Xenoblade Chronicles stuff, but going off on narrative and story things. But to come back a little bit from that digression, I've been thinking about how I just really like how Breath of the Wild's story is. I'm not going to say it's a great story, but I just love how it's intertwined with the gameplay and the world. It's something that Nintendo does very well. And I think they even do in the Xenoblade games as well, even Xenoblade 2, a game that I don't enjoy, where the story is extremely important in Xenoblade 1, 2, and 3, but the gameplay is Nintendo typically has it where the story is in service of the gameplay, not the other way around, which is how a lot of other, for lack of a better, AAA games generally are story first, gameplay second.
You can just say Sony.
Yeah.
It's
like,
okay.
Guess what? Like, I this is not to speak to, I know people love the Last of Us games, but like that's a story that they were like, how do we do gameplay?
They built
for
a game around
plot.
A plot. Yeah.
Whereas Nintendo's like, we want to do X, Y, and Z in Zelda. What story do we put around that?
Yeah.
And I don't think Xenoblade is totally driven like that. I think the story is more of a guiding principle, but it's more in hand with the gameplay. And I think too, even if it's clumsily handled, how the Monado is implemented in Xenoblade 1 as being, you know, something that has story relevance and also that story relevance carries into the combat and the gameplay.
Right. It is a legitimate mechanic. Yeah.
Yeah. It's something that I will be a sucker for whenever I play a video game because I'm playing a video game. I'm not watching a movie.
Yeah. Unless you're playing Xenoblade, in which case, arguably, you might be watching a movie. But I always have a hard time. I'm somebody who I am of the opinion that the best way to tell a story in a video game is by never cutting away to a cutscene, because I think that when a video game does that, you hit the point where video games are no longer existing as video games. They're impersonating movies.
Yep.
And so like that's generic for me reference, but like Star Fox 64, while not a horribly complex story, it tells it very well because it just tells it as you experience it. There's plenty of dialogue, but it's just happening to you, not in front of you. And I always struggle a little bit with Xenoblade's story presentation from that aspect in that, well, this goes against everything I believe for how video game stories should be done because it's super cutscene heavy. But at the same time, it's like 11 hours of cutscene and 100 hours of game. So at the end of the day, it's really not that much cutscenes. And that's how I justify it to myself.
I was about to say, like, what's the percentage of gameplay to cutscene?
Right. Unless you're the IGN reviewer who somehow made Xenoblade 3 into a 150-hour game for the main campaign, which, like,
just watched
good
every
on you, bro.
Twice.
Yeah, that dude, I assume he has no side quests left undone because he doubled my playtime. That was impressive.
But, I mean, like, I feel like there's certain games where, when it comes to, like, cutscene dependency. If it's done right, I'll allow it. But once again, there needs to be a solid game to back it up. And I think even in Xenoblade, things that I don't like, I think they strike a good balance of, you know, plot and gameplay exploration stuff. Even if I know there's parts of Xenoblade 2, and there's probably parts like this in other ones. It's just that it's fresh in my mind because I think Matt pretty much calls it. I think it's like what, chapter 5 or 6, where it's like 2 hours of cutscenes and the chapter's done.
I think he talks about the one where the kids steal the boat. I like that. Me and Matt both like the Matt's storytelling script and my lore catch-up script were written in tandem without talking to each other. And both of us, when we were like, what's a quest that's dumb and unimportant? The kid stealing the boat. Both of us made jabs at that particular quest in our videos, which I was happy about. it's a boring, useless quest that you could cut out of the game and it would affect nothing. And I wish they had.
So Xenoblade 3, it is now out. You can talk freely about it, but we're eyeing to do a spoiler cast for it sometime in the future. And
yeah, once I assume Matt and Jordan will both play through it. And once Neil's about 25 hours in and has quit and playing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's when we'll aim for the spoiler cast, though, I guess.
Yeah. But I think
it's not as big a deal for you because I've already spoiled the entire game.
Yeah. That's also like, I don't feel that bad hopping in a spoiler cast, like probably more as moderator than anything else.
Yeah.
Because I've volunteered as tribute and talk. Yeah, also because I was curious about what happens in the game. Helps me expectation set. And honestly, real talk, by the time I sit down and play the game, I'm probably going to forget a lot of what you told me. And I'll probably get to moments that I'll be like, oh yeah, that's what John mentioned to me the other week.
Yeah.
But that's the glory of having you like type it out to me in a Slack message and I just glance at it because I don't totally like, I don't have the memory of you speaking it out loud. I'm just like, okay. And then it's easy to forget it.
I have told you the ending in great detail, but you have no memory of it.
Yeah, yeah. Like if you were to put a gun to my head and be like, tell me what happened, I'd be like, ah!
but I have probably predisposed you against certain parts of, like, you won't even know. You'll just get there and automatically be like, I don't think I'm supposed to like this part.
Yeah, that's subliminal messaging from John's review.
Yeah. There were some comments that were very scared by that comment in the review. And I'm like, good. I've ruined the game for these people. They haven't played it yet.
I mean, it's a tough thing to do because there's that spoiler phobia throughout a lot of coverage. But like, if you didn't, I mean, we are dancing around. I don't think it's that John didn't like the ending as much. And we won't go into any more detail about it than that.
Yeah.
But like, it's important to
how
note
do you
that,
review
like,
that?
Yeah. Especially at launch.
Well, and it's something where it's a game that's so focused on story that like you kind of have to mention it. But even if I was allowed to talk about it in detail, I wouldn't want to.
I mean, I even think I'll have to look back to see how I covered Zelda's story in Breath of the Wild.
I don't
even
remember
like Skyward Sword, because I mean, it's once again, it's like it's different than Xenoblade in that it isn't totally relevant, but I know like with both of those, I had thoughts about, I mean, Breath of the Wild and Skyward Sword back when they both launched, that like Breath of the Wild was a game that I thought the final Ganon fight sucked. But I don't think I dragged it too much because I think I also got to the conclusion after I got that I'm like, you know what, everything else leading up to here was really good. I don't think I specifically called it out. And Skyward Sword, I think I just said that like it's a cool story. Because I didn't, if Skyward Sword fell flat for me, which it absolutely did not, I really love the way that game wraps up, then I probably would have mentioned it. But I think in my review for Skyward Sword, which is mildly fresh in my memory, because I looked at it last year when Skyward Sword HD came out, I want to say I'm just that like, oh, like Zelda gets more to do. It's fun.
Yeah, no, Skyward Sword, I would have no complaints about the ending. Yeah. And Breath of the Wild was great, except for the boss fight.
Yeah.
Like, I think it almost stands out because Hyrule Castle is one of the best parts of that entire game. And so you come straight off of that into just like, oh, okay.
The rush of going there for the first time during the review period and the music kicks in. And I was like, oh, I'll try to go here earlier. And like, I got reasonably far in there with enemies that were just could destroy me. And I just like, it stealthed around. And like tried to find some secrets. It's just so cool. And Yeah, I remember I like made sure, because I think I bothered you a lot, because there was one memory that I had, that the final memory in Breath of the Wild, I could not. It's funny because I knew where it was, but I couldn't find the spot to trigger it. Like I knew the exact area where I had to be. So I had you looking at a guide. The game.
Yeah, I had access to a guide before the game came out, and so I'm like, I was trying to help Neil with it while also not spoiling anything for myself. So I'm like, what? I'm like, okay, the memories are here, and I'm like really trying not to focus.
Yeah, like
on
taking
anything
a photo picture. Yeah,
yeah.
But I did. That's funny because I was like, oh, before I even beat Ganon, I want to get this because I think there's like there. It's like the true ending, and the true ending is just like, Link, let's go explore more. Like that's mm-hmm. it. That's.
Yep.
Maybe I am disappointed by the ending of Breath of the Wild.
Once again, I mean, I think Breath of the Wild's world narrative is fantastic. Breath of the Wild's character narrative and even the conclusion of the world narrative is not very satisfying. It's not bad. It's just not as climactic as you would expect given the grandness of the rest of the game.
Especially, there are so many other games in 3D Zelda games that just have like way more impactful final bosses.
Age of Calamity had a better ending for Breath of the Wild than Breath of the Wild did.
Yeah. I mean, I think Wind Waker, like just that fight with Ganondorf is incredible. Twilight Princess, which I feel like is maybe the pattern that they were going for with Breath of the Wild, with just like the let's play the hits. But Twilight Princess, it works. Ocarina, that works. I mean, Majora's Mask is not the same kind of Ganon fight, but that also has a great climax as well. Skyward Sword, great. Breath of the Wild, but everything else is very good.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say with Breath of the Wild, it does do a cool thing where it throws you out into the open world to do the final battle, but then it doesn't use the open world.
It does. It's just basically like, this is easier scenery to do. We already made it.
Yeah, let him fly around or something. Have me chase him all over the world or something like that.
Yep.
Anyway, Xenoblade 3 also has an ending, and I won't talk about it.
But I guess as we look with Xenoblade 3 concluding the trilogy of Xenoblade 1 and Xenoblade 2.
That is what Takahashi said, isn't it?
Yeah.
He did use the word concluding.
Although I think there was, I forget that there's a very good interview with the developers with Takahashi and other people involved that's going up on Nintendo's website as we're recording. The first two have come out, including the revelation that they just straight up built the flutes that the two characters have in game and used those exact flutes to do the music for those flutes in game, which is like, it's Mitsuda just cackling because he's like, I got my wish.
There was some comment in there that was essentially to the extent of like, it's cool that people have liked the music so much in Xenoblade because now we can just do whatever we want.
Yeah,
like nobody's going to stop us if we're like, we would like to make custom flutes for the soundtrack, please.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, that's going to be now a Nintendo collector. Holy grail is like breaking into Mitsuda's house and stealing one of those flutes.
Oh, yeah, because it's not like they just built them to like the scale, like they're detailed. Like they are the flutes that Noah and Mio use. It's insane. And
this might be a Google Translate thing. I think Mitsuda tweeted that like there's three copies of them and he has one of them.
That would make sense. Yeah, no, they're so. I actually went back tonight and did a couple flute segment because they made the comment in there. They're like, yeah, they actually sound slightly different if you hear the same song played by each one. And so in that game, as an offseer for both Noah and Mio, you can like, you know, send off, if you find a corpse, you can play the flute and it like sends off their spirit. And so I actually found a couple and used Noah on one and Mio on the other one and was like, oh yeah, their flutes do sound different. Like they did record the same thing twice with two different flutes, so it would be accurate.
That's so cool.
And it's crazy cool. I love it.
So it does seem from your review, your 9 out of 10 review, that you called this kind of the best of both worlds. As you sit, having played through Xenoblade 1, 2, and 3, and we can even toss X in there for good measure, where do you think you would rank these games in this moment?
It's hard because, like, if I took out the story and was just ranking these in terms of, like, the pure experience of playing them, then either 3 or X would be on the top. Like, of the numbered trilogy, 3 is without a doubt the best gameplay experience.
That makes me very excited because that's the part that I want to be great.
And it's not even like hard because it's not even hard to consider it the best one, because like, I think a lot of people, myself included, are highlighting how many things that 2 didn't get right that this one does, where it's like, oh, okay, it doesn't have field skills and it doesn't have the gacha mechanics. And it looks at everything that didn't work at 2 and is merciless at taking those things out and fixing them, which is awesome. What fewer people are talking about is that it also does that to 1. Like, there is like, okay, they brought the gem crafting back. Gem crafting was terrible in Xenoblade 1.
I actually kind of blocked it out until I saw that you mentioned it in your review.
It's kind of RNG based in Xenoblade 1, yep. Which like people do not give enough crap to. And in this one, it's like, all right, you want the heal 3 gem? That's these specific items, and then you craft it. And then what's awesome is you craft it once, and you can have that single gem equipped to every member of your party.
That's great.
So you like it's so just player friendly, and it's cool that not only were they willing to fix things from 3, but they weren't blind to there still being some things from 1 that they could improve too. And that's why it's like with Xenoblade 2 versus Xenoblade 1, there was easy things to say, okay, this they made worse, this they made better. With this one, I can't really think of anything that isn't equal to or better than the better version of it had previously been. Now, when it comes to story, Xenoblade 1 is still the GOAT. And that will be hard to ever top, because I think Xenoblade 1 is one of the best stories ever told in a video game.
I mean, it is a very, and a lot of the you know, your lore catch-up video and Matt's video reminded me of how much I'm like, oh man, Xenoblade 1 just, it slaps so hard. It's just such, it is like the perfect JRPG story in my eyes. Well, maybe not the perfect, because I think like Chrono Trigger and Final Fantasy VI, I would put as, or at least to me, those stories are more near and dear to my heart.
Sure.
But I think that like Xenoblade Chronicles 1, as far as like, if I'm sitting down to play a new JRPG in 2022, that's what I aspire for it to be, is that kind of nonsense.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think, and this is in most cases not a compliment to a game, but the thing that I would say about Xenoblade 1's story is if you just go on YouTube and pull up a complete compilation of every cutscene, which is roughly 11 hours long, and watch it as a mini series, because they do a good job of most of like kind of the chapter breaks are an hour long, almost like they intended for you to do this. It plays really well. Like it's on, like I have watched that game because the story just standalone is incredible. It's better in the context of the game, but it just works. It's so well done. And it's just a cool story in general.
And thinking about how, and I saw some of this in the interview that Nintendo put up, with like talking about managing a large cast, because in this game, contrary to past Xenoblade games, you have 6, sometimes 7 playable characters all on the screen at once. It is insanity.
All yelling in British accents.
But the thing about it is that it seems like you start off the game where you're just kind of like a party of 3 and you quickly match up with the other party of 3, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. You start out as Noah, Uni, and Lands, which is the Kevis side, which is like the Xenoblade 1 side, before you meet up with Mio, Tion, and Senna, which are the Xenoblade 2 side.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have that party of 6, and that happens pretty early on where you just have that party locked in. And I saw, I forget whether it was Kojima or Takahashi from the development team talking about it, but they made the comment about how like we wanted to try to make sure that like every character kind of had development in an arc, and they all, like, as they reacted to these different things going on in the story, that they all had like kind of singular reactions. And it's something that, as we're talking about Xenoblade 1 and 2, which are games that you're going on a journey, you meet Sharla, you meet Melia, you meet the Nopons and everything, like there's that adventuring aspect of it. How does Xenoblade 3 handle, like I feel like that's an element of the game that is kind of missing, of that building your party as you go through the adventure. How does Xenoblade 3 handle that, and does it succeed?
And I've said this about the story in general, but it does have just a different tone to it, because a lot of like the early parts of the story, you know, you're in this party that's kind of been forced together from two opposing sides of a war, so there's a good chunk at the beginning of the story that's, you know, you have to develop those characters' trust with each other, because they literally went from fighting each other to being on the run and just sort of joining forces for the sake of convenience and survival. And so I do think that having all of the characters always out, I think it helps with character development outside of cutscenes and to make the party feel like a real thing. Like, it's honestly something that, looking back, would have been cool in Xenoblade 1. Just because, like, I mean, I remember in Xenoblade 1, like, especially because of the way your party comes together in that, I think most people, you get Shulk, you get Rhine, and then you get Sharla, which are a perfect three-person party, which is the party limit in Xenoblade 1.
Yeah.
Because you have an attacker, a tank, and a healer. Like, that is ideal. That is the party makeup you want, no matter what combination you use. And so for a lot of people, myself included, you tend to just kind of stick with them. You might swap out, you know, Shulk and Melia or something like that. But a lot of people will just stick with that party. And so you see Ricky and Dunban and Melia in cutscenes, but, like, they're not really there. They're only characters that show up in cutscenes. And this has a nice effect of making it feel, you feel like you are legitimately always on a journey with the entire cast. And you never feel like you have to, like, oh, I want to do this quest with Melia, so I need to take someone else out of the party.
Because everybody's just there.
Right. And it's not always convenient which character you take off. Like, if you want to use Ricky, you kind of need to get rid of probably Rhine. And so you can't realistically have an effective party of any combination. Like, it has to be specific setups. And so this just eliminates that.
Yeah, I mean, even that with the class system, you can kind of customize everybody to be a different style of the character, even if it seems like some of them are predisposed to certain classes.
Yeah, there are some, like, because, so everybody can use every class, but everybody's base stats do factor into that. So, like, your healer isn't necessarily just going to naturally make the best tank. Like, tanks are always going to make the best tanks, but your healer can tank. With a little work. And what I found helpful is I'd occasionally get to a boss or something where I would think, like, okay, I died really fast. Like, one of the things, I didn't even mention this in the review, but one of the little changes this game makes to the way, like, healing works is that when you get knocked out, only a healer class can revive you. And so I learned very early on that I'm like, okay, I always want two healers. Because otherwise, if the healer goes down,
we're
all fucked. So you always want at least two. And then I would occasionally hit a boss where I'm like, okay, they have a bunch of area of effect attacks that have a decent chance of taking out both healers. So I actually want three healers this time. Or I'd be fighting an encounter against just a ton of enemies. And it's like, okay, this one, I want that seventh party member to be a tank. So I have an extra focus on just drawing attention away from healers and attackers. And so being able to swap out your party's classes and then also bring that seventh party member in, which essentially, as you get more, you have a good selection of classes there too. There were a lot of boss fights where, as opposed to saying, okay, I need to go grind, it was just, okay, I just need to rearrange how my party is built. And then I'd go back in and I'd crush them without having to do any grinding, which, like the field skill thing, like the gacha thing, contributes to the game just feeling so much smoother. They're like, I got stuck on two boss fights in this game the entire time where I, like, had to actually leave and go grind. And one of them was the final boss, which is fair. So it's just, the whole thing was just so smooth. It was 80 hours, but it just felt effortless.
It was well paced
to get through. Yeah. Yeah.
So you mentioned, I mean, like being stuck on a couple bosses. How is the overall difficulty with this game? And is there any way to tweak it in any kind of settings?
So as somebody, like, I'm at this point, I've played a lot of Xenoblade, and I feel
You're
like I have
pro
a really
Xenoblader.
I feel like I don't think I'm good at it. Like, whenever I think I'm good at it, then I hear people talking about builds for Xenoblade 1, and I'm like, oh no, I have no idea what I'm doing. but I feel like I have a good sense for, like, where I should be in relation to the generic enemies to be good enough to beat whatever boss is coming up. Like, I have a good feel for their design in that respect. So for the most part, I was pretty much always the right level granted, Xenoblade does do its favorite Xenoblade thing, which is to say, like, this guy is, he says he's level 30, but he's a unique monster. So he's not actually level 30. We're just telling you he is. And it's like, why don't you just tell me what level he actually is? And like, we don't wanna. We want it to be a surprise. So outside of that classic Xenoblade bullshit, I felt like if you just kind of fight things as you go, you'll pretty much always be the right level. I rarely found myself over-leveled unless I was intentionally, like, there were a couple times where, since me and my wife play through these games together, where I would be like at work and I'd be on break and I'd just go kill a side quest, knowing full well that I'd wind up, you know, doing a bunch of these and getting over-leveled. Outside of that, I felt like I was very naturally keeping pace with the game. It does have an easy mode, which essentially makes you a god. And I highly recommend that if at any point you have, like, you stop having fun, just switch on the easy mode. It doesn't punish you in any way. There's not like a true ending if you play on different difficulties or anything like that. Nothing changes. It just makes the game easier. And you can totally use it to kill a boss and then switch yourself back to normal like nothing happened.
So like what I did with Shin Megami Tensei 5.
Sure.
There were a couple bosses where I'm like, I know what I have to do. I don't want to. I'm going to switch it to easy. And then after this boss fight, go back.
Well, and I've been doing that with my most recent replay of Xenoblade 1, where it's like, I just want to have a nice, easy time. So I play it on normal. But then if I get to a boss where I'm having trouble, I'm like, no problem. And I just switch it to casual, kill that boss and move on.
That's how I, when I was playing Definitive Edition on Switch,
yep,
that's what I was doing, is that like, I'd be like, all right, I'm going to keep this on normal. Whenever I hit any kind of wall, I'm just going to kick it down to easy and then probably bring it back up. I think by the time I stopped playing that, I was just on easy because I was just in, all right, I don't feel like grinding at all. I'm just going to kind of power through.
Yeah. And if you play on easy, you can essentially, like, if you just want to experience the story, play on easy. Don't feel bad about it. It's still fun. And as somebody who has played all of these games, I validate you as a Xenoblade fan, even if you were playing on easy. Like, it's fine. But yeah, there is also a hard mode. I haven't messed around with that as much. And oh, I can say this now. There's a new game plus, and in once you finish the game, you can level down your characters at campsites. Dear Twitter users who have been asking me that since the previews.
Only after new game plus?
After you finish the game. Okay. So you don't have to be on New Game Plus to lower your character's levels. Okay. You can do it on your primary save file.
Cool, cool, cool.
But I don't use that feature much, but I know people are extremely interested in it. And it was something that, unfortunately, I couldn't really talk about, even though I knew it was there. But yes, it is, it is technically post-game content. There's a lot of cool, like, go back to after you roll credits, like, go back and keep playing. And look for new quests that you didn't see before, because there is some cool shit in the late slash post game that you would not want to miss.
If you have any more questions about Xenoblade 3 or anything Xenoblade related, send us in some listener mail, connectivity@NintendoWorldReport.com. We'll probably be talking about this game for a while as more people play it and there's more discussion around it. And we'll have that DLC in a year and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm really excited to hear how people react to it. I'm excited for Matt to get to the ending and just absolutely love it and completely invalidate me.
Yeah, and then it'll just be you guys fighting. Will be an episode in a month or so.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to play it. I really am. Like, you've sold me on it. So if I don't like it, it's your fault.
It always is.
Yep.
Yep. It's what I do.
So speaking of listener mail that you should send into us, connectivity@NintendoWorldReport.com. We have a piece of listener mail. I believe it is from our friend Chariot Goblin.
Yeah.
Chariot Goblin wrote in saying the upcoming Bayonetta 3 will have a naive angel option that will tone down the nudity in the game. This got me thinking. Are there games that you played that you feel you could have benefited from an option like this? Xenoblade 2 definitely comes to mind. That was not my only issue with Xenoblade 2.
No, well, and honestly, like, Xenoblade 2, the thing was that, like, the funny thing is, like, people wearing clothes wasn't really the problem with the character design in Xenoblade 2 either. Like,
yeah,
most of them were wearing clothes. They were just hilariously proportioned and put in hilarious situations. Yeah.
It was like vintage DC Power Girl, but yeah. Everybody yeah. was like that.
Yeah, everybody was, I'm not sure what you would censor unless you were going to put everybody change in the like character sheets. Models. Yeah.
Everybody just wearing sheet blankets wrapped around them. There's just like a very like nervous mother being like, oh, these girls can't go out like this.
I will say too that two games that I have played in public situations where I wished I had more control over this was L.A. Noire and Witcher 3, which both love to throw naked people at you occasionally when you're like on an airplane sitting next to a stranger. So those are games where I'd like an option.
Cool thing about this is that Tokyo Mirage Sessions already has a Naive Angel mode. It is just the Western release of the game.
Yes. Yeah, permanent. But honestly, but Xenoblade X also had that ingrained into it. But that was just non-pedophile Angel, I believe, was the mode that they added.
The thing with Tokyo Mirage Sessions, which is like the game that I point to as the example of like, no, that toes the Atlas line. It does not cross it for me. I think Tokyo Mirage Sessions is an awesome game. I also think that I do think that the Western localization, which is now the true version of the game, because the Switch version is based off of that Western version.
Which is weird.
Yeah, a little so there's one part in that gets a lot of crap. And I guess it may be a little relevant to this in that. I think Tokyo Mirage Sessions in its Western release, like, I could probably stand with less boob jiggle, but I also think that some of the way that the game kind of like flaunts its characters is part of the story and like part of the vibe of that game of like, are you in a dance troupe or something?
You're an idol.
You're performing. You're an idol. You're performing. I'm like, that's part of the game. And much like Bayonetta 3, where like Bayonetta 3, it's not like it's changing the entire thing of the game. It's just like, oh, instead of her using the hair and her clothes come off, like she still has a bodysuit on. Like that's all it is.
In fairness to Bayonetta, has always like there's no nudity in Bayonetta.
Yeah, you might see like part of a butt, like that's it.
You see some cheek, but she's always wearing like a swimsuit. There's no nudity in any of the, and that's not something that like Nintendo censored my game.
Yeah, I don't think there are vagina bones in Bayonetta. And I mean, even Kamiya made a comment, Hideki Kamiya, you know, Bayonetta, I think he's like the executive director for Bayonetta 3, but like the, you know, creator of the character series, whatever. He made a comment that he's like, oh, Nintendo's never asked us to change ever and anything. Like, I think Naive Angel, as far as I know, is Platinum putting it in.
Nintendo famously asked for the Link costume to be more revealing.
Yeah.
Because they didn't feel like it was appropriate for Bayonetta to be that well clothed. So yeah, no, Nintendo is not doing anything to get Sony, in the way of Bayonetta.
If Bayonetta ever wants to put a Sony platform, it might not be allowed.
It's so weird. If she were a gruff dad, they'd let her do whatever she wanted, but they don't believe in strong, independent women, only gruff dads.
Tokyo Mirage Sessions, the only time I never played it on Switch. I played through it on Wii U, really enjoyed it. I think I reviewed it for the Nintendo Force magazine. I don't know how to find my old review. I don't remember writing it. but I think it's at the end of chapter 2 where there's like a creepy photographer. Mm-hmm. And in the Japanese version, it's this creepy photographer taking pictures of your like teenage protagonist in a swimsuit, and it's very lecherous. There's I think some sexual assault of some impropriety implied.
Yeah.
And in the Western release, she's wearing like a doofy punky Brewster outfit, and it's the same kind of like the guy's still kind of lecherous and creepy, but it's done. And I remember like looking at to see the comparisons, and of course seeing the comparisons, you're seeing the people really mad about it. And I still think the point gets across. It just, you get it across without it being creepy, because the idea is that like at the in the original Japanese version, I believe the idea of that is that like she's in that swimsuit and it's empowering. And I also took it maybe as a slightly tongue in cheek way that like she's wearing this like dumb blossom getup, and it's empowering because she's being herself. And a lot of people told me that opinion is wrong, because you couldn't see her cleavage, the 15-year-old girl's cleavage.
Yes, which is the point upon which most opinions are based. Yes. Please see the comments section of Matt's Xenoblade storytelling video for further details.
But if there's a, I'm trying to think if there's any other games like Bayonetta. I think it's a good idea. I also, I think one-handed sure. mode is coming back. One-handed mode is the funniest thing to me.
I used that one time because my wife fell asleep on my arm and I only had one arm free and I wasn't tired. And I was like, Bayonetta has a one-handed touchscreen mode. I'm going to try it.
Oh, I forgot they added the touchscreen mode for two, yeah. right?
Yeah. Yeah, so you can play one-handed on the touchscreen. It's weird. It does work.
Does it, the Switch version have that too?
I don't think I ever tried on Switch.
I might have to try that now. I've been kind of, so you know how we talked about how I wasn't excited for Bayonetta 3? Mm-hmm. I don't know if I am, but I did pre-order the special edition on Best Buy.
Yeah, you're the fucking worst. I am excited and I did not pre-order that. The Xenoblade Special Edition was
it?
Like
no.
No, the Xenoblade Special Edition was like that took away all my drive to get, like, I got that one and I'm like, cool, I'm done for a while now. Thank
it is,
you.
It is the kind of thing that the main reason why I got it was just because it was like the Best Buy link was just active and I was like, ah, sure, I'll throw in a pre-order if I want to can. I have a feeling I might cancel it and just get the regular physical version because I feel the thing where I'm not as excited for Bayonetta 3, but I also really enjoyed Bayonetta 1 and 2. So I think it's the kind of thing that, like, once I actually play the game, like, I think the trailers just don't do anything for me. But, like, that is just the action of that game feels so good.
Yeah, I'm intentionally trying not to get too excited because I do consider Bayonetta 2 a 10 out of 10 game. There's such a good chance based on that this one will disappoint me.
That yeah.
I'm trying very hard not to get hyped for it, but deep down, I am extremely excited.
Yeah, I'm planning. I think I'm going to try to play through Bayonetta 2, or at least play parts. Get to the Star Fox level and call it a day.
Yeah, that's pretty late in the game. I know because yeah. I had to get footage of it for something one time and was like, it's that far in? Dang it. Okay.
But I'm trying to think of any other games. I mean, like, definitely some of, like, the JRPGs that I've played, like, could go for that. Because there is like definitely that, like, that stylish look that I feel like Xenoblade Chronicles 2 takes to the extreme, but is something that is carried on with a lot of, like, you know, maybe I don't know if Tails is the right series to bag on. I mean,
Tails has some of that.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like it's a lot of those JRPGs, especially if I'm playing them on Switch. Like, let me just have my moment if I'm on a train, trying to grind some levels, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And Witcher 3 is another one, because that game, I haven't even played that much, but I think I there was a lot of nudity very quickly in the little bit that I've ever played of that.
Yeah, it's the first, it's the opening scene.
Yeah.
There is nudity in the opening. Like, it lets you know what it is very quickly, which, you know, is accurate to the books. I'm pretty sure multiple books start with a sex scene. So
yeah,
they're just being consistent. But yeah, that's one where, yeah, a toggle for that would be nice.
Yeah,
I feel like
that goes away. I mean, with some of that, like the nudity in games, also violence in games, like not necessarily turn off violence, but like if it is something where it is more graphic, have the ability to turn it down. I've seen that. I feel like I've seen that option in a lot of games over the years.
Yeah, like to turn off blood or make it green. Yeah,
yep.
Yeah, that stuff's good. It's something that I don't think is at the forefront of people's thinking, but I do think in a handheld game where there's more likelihood of, like, I saw a lot of people talk about Bayonetta in the context of like, oh, I can play this in the living room now, and I'm like, dude, the living room is fine because it's my house. The problem is when I'm in public around other people.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's also like with kids, like, honestly, Bayonetta being like partially naked versus Bayonetta not being partially naked, like, it's kind of like the Xenoblade 2 thing where that would not be my problem with playing Bayonetta in front of my children.
Right. Yes, that does not exactly solve it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I mean, like, sure, does it make it, like, minorly more acceptable? It still doesn't make it acceptable.
Yeah, I suppose if they walk through the room, they might be only, like, they might go to therapy for one fewer things, but, like, they're still definitely going to therapy. I've told this story
before, but during 2020, when, like, just all hell broke loose, and I was trying to work while my kid was at home. I just, like, gave him the Wii U gamepad, and that's, like, he started playing Mario 64 and stuff, and Paper Mario was great. But then he turned on Bayonetta, and I looked over, and I heard the music kick on. I'm like, no! And immediately deleted it. And then I kind of looked through my Wii U library, and I'm like, really, those are the only two games that I don't want him touching.
Yeah, there isn't, it's not a horrible library for that sort of thing. So, yeah.
All right, so let's move on to our third and final segment for the day, which, so there was, I think it was like a week or two ago, the favorite leaker of connectivity.
Our Lord and Savior.
Silex Hunter, which if you, I don't, to give a little bit of a preface, there's a lot of bullshit leakers in the Nintendo rumor scene. One that has gotten a lot of fame and fortune, really, I guess if that's what follower counts, if that's fame and
infamy,
fortune.
Infamy, maybe is the right
infamy
word.
Infamy is Samus Hunter, which is definitely an account that maybe there was some kernel of truth at some point, but they've gotten to the point where they are just basically speculating about bullshit, taking other people's rumors, passing them off of their own, being vague about things. Whenever something is incorrect, they do not admit fault. They're just like, oh, I guess the plans changed, which is, you know, real talk, sometimes the plans do change. Like, that's how it is sometimes. Sometimes, you know, Xenoblade 3 was supposed to be announced last year, and it didn't get announced until earlier this year. Like, that's just what happens. I mean, you even look back to 2020, everything got all knocked out of whack.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I believe that Mario 3D All-Stars Collection was supposed to be announced before E3, if 2020 went normally. Instead, it wasn't announced until September, but rumor leak stuff broke out about it well in advance because it was kind of known. Anyway, Samus Hunter's full of shit. That's what I'm getting at. And I've enjoyed Silex Hunter on Twitter. One, just poking fun at the concept of a Twitter account that was doing bad leaks called Samus Hunter, and then, you know, going to our Metroid Prime loving hearts and making their Twitter account, their leaker nom de guerre, Silex Hunter. And they have been really accurate. If you look back, and
yes,
I do recall, like, around the direct in February, noticing this account that I was like, oh, they got the Mario Kart DLC right. That's cool. But then they got the partner direct right. They got the fact that Persona, Mario & Rabbids, and Nier were all in it right. Which I have my industry sources, and I kind of keep an eye out to see, like, verify, like, oh, is that leaker onto something? I did not know Nier for I suspected Nier, but did not know 100% when that went up. And I kind of looked around and saw, like, oh, nobody's really talking about Nier. And then people started talking about Nier after Silex Hunter's tweet went up. and then got Bayonetta 3's release date accurate.
Release date and the announcement date of the release date.
Yeah, yeah.
Even to the time of day that it would happen. Like, it was very accurate.
I will give, like you do look at it, there's some things that, like, guess what? Nintendo does... fun fact, pay attention to 9 a.m. Eastern time and 9 p.m. Eastern time.
Sure.
Those are times when Nintendo, usually typical Nintendo press release stuff is 9 a.m. Eastern time. It is the way of the world. 6 a.m. Pacific. That's usually when review embargoes go up. It's when press releases drop. But even still, like, yeah, clearly this is an account that has some information. And all a big, long introduction about how they said that there might be something F-Zero related on the horizon. Said, don't get your expectations up, but there might be something F-Zero on the horizon. And I will be, as much as I can, I don't know for sure anything about an F-Zero thing, but I cannot rule it out. So with that in mind, we are going to play a fun game where I have a list of 99 Nintendo franchises. I'm going to click a button on my random name picker. I'll give the, in case anybody wants to know, namepicker.net is what I have this set up in. I'm going to pick a random name. It's going to pull a franchise. And then we are going to speculate if this game were coming back, what, I said Western indie studio, but we can just do, like, any kind of developer. Maybe try to think indie, because I feel like that's
outside, you look at the box.
Like, not just like, oh, they'll do an internal game.
I can't just say Sakurai for everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, that'd be fun. But kind of in line of, like, way forward doing an Advance Wars game.
Sure.
Because I feel like if there's a new F-Zero thing, it's probably at best around along those lines.
Yeah.
So without further ado, let's pick the first name. Now we're doing another one. Detective Pikachu. They're literally making a second one.
Is that a franchise? Does that count?
Sin and Punishment.
Oh, perfect. Okay. Damn it. And I'm not going to say Sakurai. Sakurai's the easy one because, yeah, like, that's all Kid Icarus was, just Sin and Punishment.
Bring Treasure back?
Let's see.
Yeah, if we can't get Treasure back, and Nintendo's like, we have to bring this IP back.
Honestly, Sin and Punishment has kind of a Platinum Games vibe to it.
Yeah, no, I'll give you that. My out-of-the-box one is, I guess, I don't know exactly, Ben Esposito, who is the guy behind Donut County and most recently Neon White. Give that man a Sin and Punishment game.
Yeah.
Because I feel like he's got the quirk, Donut County, very quirky, fun game. And then he made the weird game. And I also think just that idea of like doing something stylish and fast in like a kind of like provocative weird world with a persona-y story in the background. I feel like that's something that you could, like, dude seems like he might have the chops to be able to, you know, put together with a team. Probably this would be one that, like, maybe he is partnering. Maybe there's the remnants of Treasure working with Ben Esposito. Mm-hmm. Tora Horse on Twitter, who he had the funniest tweet today where he's just said, what is an indie game? And it was a lot of people replying, being like, your game, silly. And like, I think that's the point. but yeah, I think he could make it really like a good Sin and Punishment game.
I don't know if he's technically indie right now or not, but in a similar vein, I think Suda 51 would make a really fucking weird Sin and Punishment game. And I think I'd be interested in that. It has to be weird, weird stylized action. So yeah, like Neon White is a perfect example of that.
All right, next one, Dr. Mario.
Well, is it still a puzzle game or are we reinventing it?
I think the future is your oyster, John.
I don't know if I know my puzzle developers. you play that puzzle game that you love.
I mean, we can make this easy. Give Dr. Mario to the Quantum Astrophysicist Guild. They made Freshly Frosted, which came out. I reviewed it, gave it a 9 out of 10. It's an incredible puzzle game. They also did Tumblestone a number of years ago. Like, let them make like an adventure, like, you know. Tumblestone is a game that is like a reinvention on the falling block puzzle style. And it's something with like world maps and different levels and stuff. Make it like that. Basically make Dr. Mario World, but not a mobile game and not garbage.
Yeah. I don't know that Dr. Mario is one we need to bring back, but
Chibi Robo.
Oh, okay. Here we go. Let's see.
Oh, God.
This doesn't count, but the reality of it actually being in Nintendo I would actually want it to be the Animal Crossing team, just because I think that would be weird. But outside of that, I think it would be awesome.
Yeah, like I think there's co-directors on New Horizon or something, like have one of them go off and kind of do something with the smaller team.
I feel like it has, like, they're not the same gameplay style at all, but I feel like the very non-traditional, not quite goal-oriented gameplay.
I don't think anyone from Onion Games, I think there were people that used to work with the people at Onion Games, because I know, so Onion Games brought out that game Moon, that came out back in the 90s, and I think the team that made that, I think there were people there that wound up forming Skip, which would go on to make Chibi Robo. But I mean, give it to Onion Games. That's there's some history with the franchise, and I think they could do something good. But I'm trying to think of like something like a Western indie that could do a good Chibi Robo. I feel like there's a wholesome games kind of.
So what about the Dodgeball Academia team?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that
could fit.
I think that might work.
I forget the name of them, like the whatever they're like
Pocket Trap.
Yeah, Pocket Trap. Like, I still haven't played their previous game, which apparently like is going to have a cartoon show based off of it. Ninjin Clash of Carrots.
Oh, cool. I don't think I've even heard of that.
Yeah, game. I think it's just like a action platformer or something. I kept an eye on it. I think it's gone on like deep discount a couple times. I just haven't bid on it.
It's got nice art.
Yeah, yeah. I think they could do a really good Chibi Robo.
Yeah, I mean, that's assuming they're not making Dodgeball Academia 2.
Which would be cool.
Or really just any... I would take more weird sports RPGs from them if that's an option. Because the worst thing about Dodgeball Academia was that there wasn't more of it.
Yeah. Yeah, man.
And I want like Dodgeball Academia World Championship or something.
All right, next one, Wave Race.
Hmm. Who's good at water?
It's the kind of thing where, like, I don't know if there's an easy fit for... I feel like you need to get creative with it, because I don't think there's a lot of companies making, like, good jet ski games to do that direct comparison. So it'd be people that just, like, have... It's... You need to be able to make a game that controls well, because that's very important with Wave Race. You know, good
and I physics. Do think it should be... I do think it should be pretty.
Yeah.
Because Wave Race has always been a very technically kind of on the edge game. Here's, okay, VD Dev.
Oh, yeah. I was actually going to say, going against, because when we talked about this initially, we were going to do F-Zero, which still could come up. No Shinen for F-Zero, because it's been done to death, but Shinen,
For Wave Race
would be really good.
Yeah, VD Dev, I just thought, because they did a racing game called Rise Race the Future, which is gorgeous. Like, the Switch version holds up against the PC version. It's an incredible port. And also has like aquatic stages where you're racing on the surface of water.
Raw Thrills would be another one. Just do like Cruisin' Blast after that. Just give them Wave Race.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that one wins, actually. I would do that.
Tomodachi, which is a trick question, because if they ever do another one, they need to have gay marriage, and they're never going to have gay marriage in Tomodachi Life.
Well, who's the gayest developer you can think of? Because that's whoever that is, that's who should do Tomodachi. Then Nintendo can patch it out when it releases in Japan.
You know what? The Boyfriend Dungeon developer, Kit
there
Fox.
There you go, perfect.
Give it to Kit Fox Games.
I do like that I can feel that you just wrestled with the concept of Googling gay game developers.
But yeah, Kit Fox Games, give them Tomodachi Life. Tomodachi Life 2.
Yeah. Don't tell Nintendo until it's too
Wario.
Late.
Which, not WarioWare, Wario.
Okay, like real Wario.
Yeah.
My gut reaction was... No, okay. Platonic.
Yeah.
Because they did Yooka-Laylee. More importantly for this, Yooka-Laylee and the Impossible Lair.
Yep.
Because my initial reaction was Retro Studios, which doesn't count because that's internal.
But I would say that would be neat.
But I want, sure. But yeah, just trying to think of like good 2D platformer developers.
I mean, Yacht Club.
Assuming it's
2D. Yeah.
Oh, Yacht Club would be great, actually. Yeah.
Yacht Club also, I had another one on the tip of my tongue. What did you say initially?
Platonic.
Oh, God, I'm totally a brain fart. I'll say Yacht Club.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Either one of those.
Yeah, I'll stick with Yacht Club. Or even, here, the one that was on the tip of my tongue, Image and Form. I know they're Thunderful, specifically the SteamWorld team doing a Wario game.
I'm so excited for their 3D SteamWorld game.
It might be terrible, but I'm in.
It might be, but the gunk was good enough that I want to see them do more 3D stuff.
Donkey Konga.
Oh, okay, that word did not end how I expected it to. Does anyone still exist that makes rhythm games?
I mean, Harmonix got bought by Epic, so that's out.
Is it just like the drum mat, the Taiko Drum Master games now?
I mean, that's pretty much what it was in the first place.
Is easy, yeah.
I believe, because Bandam, I think, made this back in the day.
That's another one where I don't know that it's like Dr. Mario, where you pretty much just need somebody who can develop a game. And then you need Nintendo to license them some songs. Though, actually, if we're going to make it, the important thing with the new Donkey Konga is to put some Donkey Kong music in it, please.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Like, it's a series with an incredible soundtrack.
Yeah.
And you're like, what about like 90s light rock?
Here's a weird one. Give it to Rare.
Okay.
Just imagine the announcement where like Rare is coming back, you know, that it worked out a deal with Microsoft for a small team to work on a new Donkey Kong game.
The A is like really small.
Steel Diver.
The problem is that I immediately, like, that's already developed by an indie studio.
Yeah, it's already by Vite.
Yeah. So I'm not sure.
Chu-Hai,
I mean, you can,
Labs.
I was gonna say you can shuffle it around the white guys in Japan studios of Vite, Chu-Hai, Q Games, and 17-bit. One of them will take it.
But I'm trying to think of like a Western indie dev that could do Steel Diver. Oh, the Earth Atlantis developers. I don't even know what they're doing. But did you ever see what that game looked like? It wasn't that good, but the style for Earth Atlantis was awesome. It was an indie, it was a side-scrolling shooter.
Oh, yes,
shooter.
I did.
Yeah.
Okay, I immediately see why you would pick this. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you're literally in a sub. It's a neat game. I just remember it being kind of, it was okay. It looked better than it played. It looks like they're working on some kind of new game called Krut, the Mystic Wings, which I think like literally comes out soon. I think I saw it coming soon on the eShop.
Oh, I remember getting PR for that. Yeah, I didn't realize that was a developer I would recognize. Yeah.
Well, you should check out this game, maybe. I don't know. 2D side-scrolling action platformer.
Instead of pitching them new things they should make, maybe we should play their damn games.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Look at that. Yeah, this game's coming out like very soon.
Well, all right. Glad we thought of it.
Egg on my face. All right, this feels fitting. We picked F-Zero.
Okay.
So no Shining. But just,
can't be Shining.
Yeah.
I also already used up VD Dev, which was my other go-to Pretty Racer company. And controversial take, I don't want it to be the Redout team.
Yeah.
Because those games are fine, but it's not the right kind of futuristic racer, I don't think.
I wish we didn't use the Dodgeball Academia team.
Oh, that'd be weird.
Yeah. Because I'm trying to think, it's like something like give me a unique take on F-Zero. Because I mean...
Okay, here you go. It's Square Enix. It's in the HD 2D engine. And it's pretty much just SNES F-Zero, but like with a lot of bloom.
Can you imagine Mode 7 graphics in HD 2D?
Honestly, that would be cool once.
Yeah.
Kind of like how HD 2D was cool once.
You just defined HD 2D. Is this going to be a bit now? You know what sucks about it is that I don't even think it's like I don't think HD 2D looks terrible. It's just that I want variety. No. That's it.
It's just that they've now put out three games, soon to be four with Dragon Quest, that all look like the same game.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing. Like, that's not how engines work. You can't blame the engine for that. That's just you making three of the same looking game.
Yeah. And it's just like, let's put Final Fantasy VI in HD 2D. It's like, bro, like the pixel remasters are beautiful.
Yeah. Well, I would even say you can put it in HD 2D, but don't make it look like a sad sepia tone game full of bloom and light rays. Like, just give it a different, like, you know how SNES games didn't all look exactly the same? This is that. Like, yep. You can draw pixel art that looks different.
But what else?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So we don't want that to have to happen to F-Zero.
No. I need to, like, think of more indie devs.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of racing games or like weird. I mean, you could of course give it to the Yakuza team.
Yeah, no, I mean that's another obvious one.
Yeah.
Let's look at recent games. Cause I wanna find a good one. I wanna pair this. This means a lot to me.
Could give it to Bertel Horberg.
I don't think that's probably more realistic than some of the other things.
He'd fucking nail it, I can tell you that much. Man doesn't miss.
Let's see. F-Zero. Let's give it to... Oh, the people who made Dead Cells. Let's see him do that.
Okay.
Sure.
Can they make 3D games?
I don't know. We're gonna find out.
I feel like that's important. It's like a top-down sprint car racer.
Yeah, it's actually
Micro Machines.
It's RC Pro-Am. Guess what, not a lot of indie devs do like badass 3D racing games.
Well, especially when you take out Shinin and when I don't want the Redout team.
Yeah.
Especially when the Redout team has shown they can make like a mildly competent Star Fox clone. I'd kind of rather they went and did that, to be honest.
I don't know. It's hard, man. I'm just trying to like think of anyone. Like I'm literally just scrolling through a list on like top rated Switch games to see if there's anything that sparks any kind of indie dev. What about like the Warframe developers?
Who are who's the developers behind Race with Ryan? That probably lean into that. Who did you don't like Team Sonic Racing, right?
Oh yeah, give it to Sumo
Digital.
Yeah, give it to Sumo.
Yeah, because they also did Sonic and Racing Transformed.
I don't think Sumo is the problem with Team Sonic Racing. I think that, sure. that is a game that strikes me as Sega was like, make this game, and they're like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like yeah, we made it to spec.
Give it to Sumo.
Like we made this great game. Why do you want us to make a worse version of it? Which is, I mean, the team mechanic in Team Sonic Racing didn't work for me. And I also liked my Sega racing game when it was all of Sega and not just Sonic.
Yeah.
Like, let me race as Gilius Thunderhead, you MFers.
Yeah, it does need more Skies of Arcadia.
Yeah, yeah. Give me Vice or whatever his name is.
I did briefly pitch that to Katie from We Finished Xenogears. Skies of Arcadia is on my Xbox, and I'm like, man, I played that.
Is it the Dreamcast or the GameCube version?
It's the GameCube version.
Okay, so I played through it on
Dreamcast.
Is there
a significant difference?
I believe the load times on the GameCube version are way better. The load times on the Dreamcast version are a horror show.
I'm also assuming that playing it on the Xbox probably means there wouldn't be that much of a difference in load times.
Yeah, probably.
But yeah, I kind of want to. I played that back around when it came out on GameCube and remember actually getting really into the vibe of it. And I haven't played it since. So I'm debating replaying that.
Here, I have one final one that happened to be like I just clicked through another. A developer other than the one that's making it now, who would make another Xenoblade Chronicles?
Oh, that would be a fucking crime.
Tetsuya Nomura.
You could give it to Sakaguchi and then Takahashi could make a Final Fantasy game and we could just watch the world burn.
Yep.
Honestly, if it was like the Last Story style Sakaguchi, then like, maybe. That's such a hard, because like the...
I mean, it is like that one feels like impossible because I don't think Xeno anything exists without Takahashi involved.
The everything from like the story to just how the world is so intrinsically tied to that developer that like you cannot attach it to anyone else in a way that I can't really think of a lot of other games like that.
Because even I mean you look at like they kind of didn't I mean you see a lot of those I mean like those Capcom people like your Kamiyas and your Mikamis, like those dudes left their franchises like that happens.
Yeah.
And they still went on, even, you know, Final Fantasy, those dudes left. I guess Kingdom Hearts without Nomura would be probably the closest.
It might get better.
Even Smash Brothers without Sakurai is a little bit like that. And I think Smash Brothers without Sakurai is a thing we will likely see.
Next Smash Bros.
Probably.
I hope it's the next Smash Bros.
I mean, because it's the kind of thing where if, let's say, Takahashi's like, I'm done with video games. He's like, Xenoblade 3 Chronicles is perfect. Never making another one. Like, they just would stop making Xenoblade games, probably. They'd probably like, all right, we'll do the export, and then we're done for now. But like,
they'd go to his wife, Soraya Saga, and be like, so are you done with video games?
You're doing this now?
But
I feel like if Nomura were to be like, I'm done with Kingdom Hearts right now, like, they'd still make Kingdom Hearts games.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Connectivity. If you want to send us any listener mail, maybe pitch your Western indie studios to the games that we were talking about or other Nintendo franchises, feel free to write in to connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. That email once again is connectivity@nintendoworldreport.com. If you don't want to send us an email, you can hit us up on Twitter at connectivitynwr. That Twitter account again is connectivitynwr. Some housekeeping before we go. The 3D Zelda Game Club that we were doing We played Ocarina of Time and Majora's Mask, and then Breath of the Wild 2 got delayed, and we kind of like, we're going to pause to see what happens. We are either going to jinx it, and Nintendo will announce Wind Waker HD coming to Switch immediately after we record our episode for Wind Waker. But we are currently planning to do an episode about Wind Waker in the end of August. We kind of have a loose timeline going on, but it is the kind of thing that we'll probably be a little bit fluid with, since we have a number of more months than we expected, with Breath of the Wild 2 being in the 2023 and maybe beyond. But Wind Waker for the end of August, probably Twilight Princess in like November, maybe later, because that might be just, you know, end of the year hullabaloo. But then we'll probably do Skyward Sword in kind of short order, since a lot of us played it with the HD version recently. And we'll probably cover some Link's Crossbow Training. And that'll, by that point, by the time we get to talking about Skyward Sword at like the beginning of next year or whatever, we might have a date for Breath of the Wild 2. So like our timeline might get changed around then. So, but for now, play some Wind Waker if you want to, and we'll talk about it at the end of August.
Yay! All right.
Bye!
Bye! This was made possible by our generous supporters on Patreon. Check out patreon.com/NWR for all the details.